That should be, there we go. I know I don't like opening with the "and we're live," but it you do have to fill a little bit of air whilst you're kind of going live. Otherwise, you have a weird pause there too.
Yep.
It definitely is working. I'm seeing it on the front end as well.
Yes, so, it is running.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I'll tell people to refresh. If people are still saying late, but yeah, we are definitely going here. So
cool.
Yes, hello everybody. Hello.
And how are you doing, mate? I know you've been a little bit poorly this week,
I've been right under the weather, to be honest.
Yeah.
I have quite a bad cold. It's just been a cold. It's just been a bad cold, basically.
Not a mysterious coof. You've been tasting your food just fine. I hope.
Yes.
See, other illnesses can occur. It seems good. I'm glad to hear you're feeling better though, because I'm not going to say I was relieved to hear you sort of, oh no, I can't do the big stream, but I was, oh okay, good, I can take a break, I can play my computer games for a change. Which has been...
Yes. No, that's fine. no, it's a case of... Well, actually, we've had a lot of stuff crop up. We say it's a Q&A. Yes, we will be taking live questions.
Yeah.
And obviously donations will take priority. But we also have had a huge amount of comments and feedback and just minor corrections, if I can speak.
Yeah.
On what we've been doing.
Give it a go.
So it's... Yeah.
Yeah, no, I noticed I'd said something, I think it was the last one, where I'd got the 18th and 19th Amendment the wrong way round, and various other stuff like that, so yes. Yes, as Scholars just said in chat, no more homework. I have bunked off the homework for the week a little bit.
Although, well, like I said, the chronology on the 18th and 19th Amendments are a bit weird.
Yeah.
But I think it was to please what they knew was going to be the female electorate. And there was a lot of voting on a state level and campaigning on a state level as well, which is what we talked about. Also, the fact that it lasted till 1930 is kind of an affectation of kind of women as a special interest temperance group. But we're, again, getting ahead of ourselves here.
I think they still are. I hate to mention it, but I've noticed a little bit of my women as a political activist group still cracking on today, 100 years later. I don't know if anyone else has noticed that. Maybe there are other YouTubers out there mentioning feminism bad. I don't know. Who knows?
But yeah, we don't have a lot of time to just do the normal waffle stuff during these streams because they're so dense during our other streams. But yeah, this is much more free format. We'll mainly be talking off the top of our heads here. No more scrambling through the notes and being like, shit, we have, you know, 10 topics more to cover. It's already been half an hour.
Yeah.
It's a little bit stressful, but it's definitely worth it.
I know I've said this before. I'm really enjoying it. I'm really enjoying being able to get my teeth into a good project, and it's so far been really, really good on that front. And lots of learning, and lots of, my God, they were helping the communists. How idiotic can they be? But yeah.
Oh yeah. Once you really get into like the nitty gritty of, you know, actual history, and you start studying a lot of, you know, also people like Sutton. Obviously, we're going to talk about. At some point, we are going to actually cover Burnham himself. We're going to have Soul brought in. You know, some Ted Kaczynski near the end, too. We're going to have everybody.
Well, we were about to dive into... What was it going to be this week? It was going to be 1920 to 1930. And that's again, that's another one where, oh, we'll just do this period. It's a massive period of time. We've got all sorts of characters to introduce during that time. We could mention.
Yeah, we do. We have a lot of people. We haven't even got to Mr. Hitler yet.
Mr. Hitler, Mr. Mussolini, Mr. Oswald Mosley.
Oswald Mosley comes into it. Roosevelt comes into it. I mean, look quickly behind the scenes, but we make copious notes on these.
Oh, God, yeah.
There's a huge amount of stuff we just link in the private little Discord that we use here. And there's also just, like, I started working up a Google Doc for all of these, too. Mm-hmm. So each stream has, like, literally 5 pages of notes and links. That's partially where the links, all the references come from on the reference stuff, which I know I've been a little bit slow with last time. But that was due to YouTube's community feature actually spazzing out a bit.
Oh, okay.
it wasn't liking it, and YouTuber has actually on the back end sent out a small apology message for a whole bunch of stuff that wasn't working.
Yes, no, yeah. I've seen you putting up the community links,
the references. I usually edit them into the description and the pinned comment as well, so people can, you know, I would encourage people to read around this subject.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if nothing else, definitely have a bash at Anthony Sutton's work. Out of all of them, there's a lot of sort of 350 page documents we're pouring through. Anthony Sutton's is only a mere 83 tabs or pages on a PDF. But it's really good, really eye opening. And that's the which one was it? That's the Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution work. In fact, let me. I know we've seen it. Let me see if I can grab a quick screen picture of it somewhere. Why isn't that working? Of course it's not working because we've gone live and now it's not going to play ball with me.
Ah.
There we go.
Yes.
That one.
Well, there's someone in the comments. Oh, there's a good question there, actually. A good piece of feedback.
Cool.
Thank you, James Mary, in the comments saying, "Now I like your stuff, but I got to give you some pushback, especially with the Parliament Act. Yes, power grab, but I don't buy the socialism was not a force in the UK at the time. You had the Wobblies, the general strikes, the anarcho-syndicalists." Well, the general strike was that. Oh, Trig, you're showing the YouTube thing instead.
Ooh, I am. Hold on, that's
Trig, that's so boomerang.
Yep. Sorry, my bad. I've only got one browser open. I'm trying to do it all from one browser, and yes, that I will.
Well, there
we go.
We didn't need to get into it too much, but a lot of the Engels and Marx in the UK stuff, a lot of that is tacitly supported by people like Lloyd George. Covering the feedback loop between the British Labour movement, the New Liberals and the British Labour Party and the establishment at the time isn't something that falls within the remit. But what I was saying is there wasn't actually the risk of an organic socialist revolution in the UK. What they were doing was they were essentially doing what they do now in that they were creating pushback to advance their own agenda.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's a whole other topic in of itself, the kind of AstroTurf. And the general strike was 1926, by the way, James Murray. And, you know, the Parliament Act was 1918. So there's a bit of time in between the two of them, but I get your point. There were the Wobblies, you know, there were the syndicalists, but there weren't mass organic movements there.
No.
That chat window's so small.
I know.
Most people can probably just see it on the playback.
You know, if you got the, I've just like opened the window to look at it on YouTube. As long as it's on full screen, it actually doesn't look terrible. But it is difficult for me to see on
OBS.
Yeah,
we've got some legacy stuff here, guys. There's a chat app I've been trying to get working through Streamlabs, but it hasn't been playing ball. We had a bit of a time to tunnel there. Apologies, but. Again, looser stream. You've actually been doing really well on keeping up with, holy shit, we have like 14 screen transitions during this and like 7 sources in each. It's been a bit full on.
In fact, let me see if I can find it. I did a screen capture of the amount of tabs I had open on just one browser the other day, and I think I got something like 27 tabs on the browser, and it was just lots and lots and lots of tiny little icons running across the top, and someone in the server saw it and was freaking out.
The Liverpool general strike. There were some labour issues at the time, but a lot of them were over specific issues. They weren't like, we want communism. And what happened was that before the general strike, the Liberal Party very specifically empowered the unions. Like, if they were really worried about communism, what they would do is they would disempower the union movement, remove all of its legal legitimacy, and what they would do is they would, you know, have murdered people like Marx and Engels rather than assisting them, which is largely what they did, rather than assisting people like Lenin and the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and all this. There's a lot of like bolstering from the establishment of the Wobblies and the movements in the UK at this time, whilst also pretending to be afraid of them.
You know,
same stuff you see today.
You know what they also use it as? 1920. There was an act in 1920 called the Firearms Act. And yes. that was oh no, no, these pesky Bolsheviks have done horrifying things over in our friend Russia. We better make sure that we take military-grade firearms out of the hands of the general public.
Yes, they did, whilst also behind the scenes assisting them. It's hilarious.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But yeah, we didn't have time to get into that because it was one of the things that was discussed before the stream with our assistant Duncan was talking about that.
Yes.
The fact that there was a huge amount of astroturfing going on and that they used the socialists as an excuse. And yes, they did it. You know, there was a threat at the time, but they were also empowered by the establishment. You know, it's like the activists today. It's like exactly the same with like the Black Lives Matter stuff. Black Lives Matter is like a state-funded organization.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's
same with the Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's government-funded NGO out there creating nonsense and hardship for the police. Who, I mean, just look at what Biden's done. Look at what Biden has done since he has been in power. He's put more money and more military equipment in the hands of the U.S. police force than anyone in years. Yes, and it's all under one, yeah. The look at these pesky BLM and Extinction Rebellion people that, you know. We need to militarize the police force. So, you know, I hate to sort of, you get what you deserve, but,
Vic, there's no text in the lower third here, and there's none of our icons either.
Oh, that is very boomer. How did that happen? That's...
I think there's some layers messed up here.
There was some layers.
Again, we actually have been practicing. We've done, like, switching practices. We're almost, like, we're kind of live recording videos. Before we get too far in it, though, I'd like to thank everyone who's joined the channel recently, because there are quite a few of you. We actually have, I think, 9 members now. So thanks for that. That's one of the only kind of recurring ways people can support us. So thank you to, kind of, from most recent to oldest. The real Yaddle, again, these are all Venus Bro levels, so thank you for not being cheap either.
Yeah, no, no, thank you. Can,
we are fully monetized. You can join down below to get very YouTubery. So yeah, that's the real Yaddle, Be Happy, Sock Addict, Canadianistan, Velicus, I always have trouble with that, Wig, Cerberain, Wind Talker, and Wes. Wes Wyvern. So, thank you guys.
Yeah, thank you very,
very
much.
Very, very good. Yeah.
Thank you. In fact, speaking of being very, very YouTube-y, a couple of friends of mine earlier today were suggesting that I become a VTuber. I don't know if I've told you about
terrible.
This. No, wait. It gets better. / worse. Based around the character Sato from Arjun. I don't know if you know Arjun. And I'm not a massive weeb, but Arjun, actually, we watched the other day, and is a really, really good character. I've got to say, he's like this Irish-American dude who, well, he's unkillable for a start, which is a good power. But yeah, no, he's very, very smashed the state, and gives me my own state for my people type character. Kind of like him. I enjoyed it the other day. And, yeah, no, now I have Dai and a few other people going, oh, we should make you a character so you can VTube like that trick. So, I don't think I will. But I might. Depends.
Yeah.
Depends how much a whore for
thank
money
you, James
I'm...
Thank Mary. And very pertinent questions there.
Oh, okay.
Like I said, a lot of it does, like, it, I would say it only appears to solve the problems at the time. You ask, with the whole Lords thing, we talked about 1914, and yes, it's on the surface of it a solution. And once again, to regular, yeah, there we go. It's on the surface of it a solution to what's going on there. But really, all it functionally does is, you know, if they were really interested in setting up proper democracy, they would have created a second chamber that was an actual check and balance rather than neutering the second chamber and, you know, the UK having only the parliament and nothing else now. They basically just destroyed what was there and never replaced it and fixed it. So I think that's, I think it's kind of a telltale sign of that they wanted to empower themselves rather than build a better system, because it's been 100 years and essentially the Lords is still kind of the same ceremonial rubber stamp house, but pretends to be a check on Parliament.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
We'll go into a lot more of the stuff on that. Sorry, go on, Drake.
I was going to say, no, you're absolutely right. What they did to the House of Lords, which for a very long time, basically since Cromwell, it had acted as the second house as a way of being a check and balance for the House of Parliament, for the Commons. And since the Parliament Act, it has been so neutered. And I mean, these days, more recently, it's not just been neutered, it's been highly politicized by people like Blair and so on, who filled it with temporary life peers who were essentially Labour, ex-Labour MPs. And yeah, you end up with a house that is essentially it has nothing. It does nothing apart from smells vaguely of pee and costs the taxpayer a huge amount of money, because these guys are getting hundreds and hundreds of pounds a day just to turning up and falling asleep, by and large.
Yes. Well, the thing is, what I would say is, yes, a lot of these pieces of legislation have laudable aims on the surface of them. Same in the UK, same in the US. What we're trying to get at here is, don't look at that. That is a stage show. Look at the actual results. And the functional actual results is that life doesn't really get better for the people, at the bottom. You know, the bottom kind of, 1% or the bottom, 50% or whatever it is, not the 99%. In relative terms, their position stays the same. And what happens is that the government gets more powerful. It doesn't matter how laudable their aims were on paper. It doesn't matter if their intentions were good or bad. It doesn't matter if they are blind idealists or pure Machiavellians. What matters is the results. And that's really what we're trying to show here, is that, outside of the niceties and outside of the, laudable rhetoric of democracy, behind that, you have 100 years of these results going on. More than, 100 years now. But, it's really just, it's 100 years since all of it really kicked into high gear. And the result of mass democracy hasn't been paradise. If on paper democracy was as good as they said it would, the world would not be the same as it is now. I don't know. It's the case against democracy. The more you read about it, the more it seems to mount.
Because
it's a convenient system. Like I said, on paper, it's a convenient system when you think about it. But nobody in school really is ever taught the logical implications of it. Nobody is ever actually taught. They're never actually taught to think critically about it. Well, you're only ever propagandized about it.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't. I mean, and it doesn't take very long to realize that a majority of 51%, taking the 49% stuff, just because they voted for it is a little tyrannical at best. I've never been a massive fan of it. Anyone that knows me will know. I've said this before. I've always been a big fan of not exactly the Roman imperial system, but certainly the system that Julius Caesar, after he first took, after he basically sort of dealt with the triumvirate and took over, was trying to. This is what got him stabbed to death on the Ides of March. Was he wanted to declare himself dictator for 10 years. And after which the Senate would be reconvened and a new system put in place. And I've always liked this idea of having a strong leader who has consistently shown he has the best in mind for his populace, to be able to be put into position and run a country for a chunk of time that is long enough to actually accomplish something, so he's not persistently recovering from an election, doing stuff for a couple of years so that he can get elected again at the next election, because all that does is give you small, short-term, short, quick gains. There's no long-term planning. There is never anything that for the good in the future. There is never any. You don't see the building works that gets done under a monarchy system, under an imperial system. They were always. Always building for the future in those periods of time. You had massive monumental works going off. These days, nothing like that. You get steel and glass structures being built. Everything's short term. Everything is temporary. And as we've seen, it has just been persistent incremental power grabs, in actual fact. And How much can the Prime Minister or you know whatever get out of the system for me for the future? Definitely, or in a short period of time, seems to be how a democracy
works. It's like the CEO trap. It's like the idea that these CEOs come in, get millions of pounds of bonuses, and then just leave. You know, term limits are pretty. You know, they're good for some reasons. They'd be very good on. You know, they're very good on people like senators and congressmen because, you know, perpetually being in power is a bad thing as well. But it's the idea that elected officials, like I said previously, don't actually face as much scrutiny as a king would.
No.
Whereas in some cases they can be more powerful and have, in the modern sense, more stuff, you know, within their control to do to the populace, especially with the advances of technology. Mm. It's kind of a weird thing that the ancient kings, despite being, you know, all powerful in terms of rhetoric and all powerful on paper, actually struggled to enforce their will on the populace because they had to do it directly and manually. And people knew that you knew who the ruler was and you knew who the ruled were.
Yes.
Also, thank you, Portrait Seal, for joining as a member. That's pretty cool.
Am I calling for a French-style elected dictatorship? almost. I've not quite formulated, James, where I stand exactly on this, but there's something to be said for it, and I'm playing with different ideas at this point.
Where people draw the line is different, but what you want to do is whoever is in charge, quote unquote, and wherever you vest authority, it's very clear. I would hope from what we're seeing in the series that it needs to be incredibly pared back.
Yes.
And that, you know, from a kind of Mises, Rothbard, and especially like Hopper sense, that's kind of like the pipeline there from kind of you go from business cycle to, you know, the cycle of rotor blades in that progression.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's very clear from the writing of those people, you know, they. Some of them say very limited state, some of them say no state, but it's certainly true that what you need to make sure the state has is not a monopoly over the money supply.
Yes.
You cannot have a situation like... we'll keep mentioning it, the Federal Reserve is kind of... it's almost the root of all evil throughout all of this. The kind of experimentation in economic interventionalism is really the through line in all of this, and it what sets all of it apart, and it's what really makes the 20th century the 20th century. The idea that the politicians are these, you know, policy gods, and that instead of just measuring the market and measuring people's exchange, the economics is actually supposed to regulate it and create it and, you know, artificially constrain it. And that was not an idea that was around until the 20th century, really. It was not an idea that certainly was put into practice until then. So that really is kind of... it's the twin thing. It's the democratization, but it's also coupled with central banking. But the question we have to ask, and we will have some more special episodes in this, don't worry. There's a lot more to be discussed here, but there will be an episode at the end of this talking really about the effect of all this and the coupling of the two, and it'll be more of a pure theory episode and a, you know... We're having to really just show people events and consequences of events and myths about events, but it's important to do that because, like, I don't know, I don't want to sound too grandiose, but this is really just a base to build on, and I don't think people will be able to fully understand what comes next without this. And you have to start at the roots, and you have to start kind of, you know, 1900 is relatively modern in, you know, like, galactic terms, in universal terms, but I think it's a far enough point away that we can detach ourselves from it, detach ourselves from the myths of it to an extent, and really pull a through line from where we were then to where we are now, and how the events in between that were taught to us in school, in that sense, do not hold and hang together when you look at them. They do not make sense, and it's really kind of a process of, I don't know, it's almost like deprogramming when I talk to people about this.
Oh, very
also,
much so.
Thank you for joining the HK9410. I saw you did a donation through Streamlabs. I've got a shill. I'll let you talk for a bit. Sorry, I'm rambling again. But Streamlabs is the best way to donate to us. I have a donation link in the description. It's also the pinned comment in the chat here. I got a $10 donation last week during our premiere. Thanks for bearing with us with the change in format there, guys. Saying, shame it's not live, which means there's no chance for Trigg to do an anti-communist rant. Oh, well, we kind of recorded it live, technically.
Yes.
But, we tried to keep the spirit of it. But thank you for the $10 donation, then. Thank you for joining, HK9410, my favorite fictional firearm.
Hold on a second. James has just brought up this. Sometimes I feel you two are too rich, too southern, to really understand some stuff. Scrum Printer Uni and Trigg went to Rugby or Repton or wherever. Real middle class.
Well, I live in the north of England and I never actually went to university. I studied remotely.
Guilty as charged on that. Yes, I am rather middle class on that front. But this is... You also... You know, I was basically penniless throughout my 20s. I've done an awful lot of stuff off my own back. My parents were just a very much a case of, right, you're out there, you're 18, off you go. I'm not gonna buy the fact that you've got the wrong accent. Therefore, yes, of course I sound southern. That's so what? Who cares?
No, me, what's talking to me.
I don't think
to southern people I sound southern.
Nah, you don't sound southern.
I think I enunciate.
Yes.
But that's, you know, that's kind of different. I don't know. People round here don't think I'm round here because everyone round here sounds like Peter Kay. But that's different. People think I'm Canadian, which I take insult to. Some people think I'm American. Some people think I'm Southern. I just have a quite generalized accent where I try and, you know, actually talk properly. Because it might be a bit weird if I start talking, you know, I can actually revert to being very Northern. It might be a bit weird for you guys. Because this is generally how people around here talk, and it's not me putting on an accent. Well, I guess it is me putting on an accent because I don't actually talk like this. But you can revert to to a more northern stance without being a bit too silly with it. It's somewhere between maybe Peter Kay and Fred Dibner.
All right, mate.
I don't know. It'd be a bit weird if I was talking like this because people wouldn't understand it.
Put the pie down, mate. Put the pie down.
No, it's, okay. It's my pie, Trigg. No, I'm fair clempt. We can go on tangents here, but I still remember my mum telling me a story when she walked into a pie shop, and obviously all the northern people have a lot of their own slang. And this guy walks into the pie shop, and the poor girl, who's like her first day, and he walks up to me and goes, "Hey, you art to eat? I'm fair clempt." She goes, "You what?" And he goes, "You art to eat? I'm fair clempt." And the woman says, "No, he's saying, have you got anything to eat? He's really hungry."
Oh, I'd love running into people with strong dialects, where it's basically like listening to another language. It's great fun. Yeah, it's had that experience recently.
Fair clempt
is good. That's awful.
that's pretty out there in the weeds.
That's a bit north for me. That is, I'll tell you.
It's funny when you hear that story, though. But yeah, no, the reaction to the series, though, to get back on track, has been really quite enormous, to be honest. A lot more people donating, a lot more people joining. I've had a lot of good feedback from it. A lot of people are just very hungry for this kind of content.
Well, that's
I
think we are hitting, as you said, it's stuff that isn't usually taught in schools. BBC Bite Size covers the First World War and the lead up to it in about 8 or 9 pictures, short pictures. It's, you know, oh, this guy got killed in Sarajevo. Everyone was in different peace treaties, so they all went to war, and lots of people died, and Russia had a revolution, and that's it. And you're left going, hold on a second. You just brushed over one of the most important periods of history in 8 pictures with a bit of text next to it. It's horrifying.
It's kind of a case of, unless you're involved in a lot of the, what I would consider, libertarian esotericism, really, these days, is that there's a lot of inside baseball going on. Like, maybe less than like 0.5% of the population would know what you're talking about when you said the First World War was caused by credit expansion, because it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. you know, you can't have mechan. I know we drilled it into people when we did that episode, and I'm glad most people went with it and understood what we're talking about. But you cannot have the First World War without the Federal Reserve and credit expansion, without, you know, expansion of state inflation, without the you know, the Germans experimenting with essentially what is monetization, and, you know, the first kind of vestiges of modern monetary theory. The war doesn't perpetuate and it doesn't exist in the form it exists without that. But if you talk to, you know, 1,000 people, I doubt that, you know, more than 10 of them, might even be one of them, who would understand what you meant by that.
Yeah.
Like, that's how kind of inside baseball a lot of this stuff is to the general populace. I don't know, I guess people around these parts are a bit more educated and a bit more well-read, honestly, because I'm very impressed with how, like, how well people have interfaced with material, because it is very outside of most people's norm.
Oh, it's way outside the norm. Way outside the norm to even discuss. And, well, let's face it, a lot of people don't even look at history. My history, and this is going back when I was being taught history back in the 1980s, it sort of started roughly at about where we are now, about the 1920s. You basically came out of the First World War. It was, you know, rise of Hitler, Verhoor Putsch, you know, this, that, the other happened in Europe, Weimar Germany, Second World War, and then the assassination of President Kennedy. That was my history GCSE. That was all I did. A lot of that was, oh, well, let's have a look at propaganda in the press, and, you know, let's have a real explore on JF Kennedy, because no one was buying that.
I've been reading bits and pieces of this stuff for years, honestly. But I've, you know, I've done a lot of research for this show, you know, like you have, of course.
Oh, God,
Of this stuff has been kind of gestating within my psyche for a long, long time. Probably since I did history A level, actually, because we had a very good teacher. And one of the first things that puzzled me, one of the first things I did a huge amount of research on, is why were the Allies surprised that Stalin turned on them? Because it seems really weird. We're going to talk about this in the episode about the Second World War and post-war stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the first inkling of this is like, okay, why were they surprised by this? You know, why were they shocked by the fact this terrible dictator that they'd allied themselves with? And by the way, why did they ally themselves with him if they were supposed to be liberating Europe for democracy?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they, you know, let's go ally with this dictator to fight that dictator who, you know, they're both, you know, equally as bad. You can make arguments that Stalin was worse or Hitler was worse, but really you're just playing, you know, who's the biggest monster at that point. We can say that they're both just unconscionably bad leaders.
Dived into the Second World War because of the invasion of Poland to go in against the war, against Hitler, but then ally ourselves with the other group that also invaded Poland.
Yeah, that was a mystery to me, especially
massively
from a
post-war
perspective.
Yeah.
The thing is, what happened at things like the Yalta Conference and all of that was Winston Churchill and FDR sat down on a map and basically said to Stalin, you can have this bit, we'll take this bit. They just divided the world amongst themselves as the victors, because they didn't, you know, again, it's the elite class, they didn't give a shit. It's the same as it was, mm-hmm. you know, after the First World War, as we talked about. They just drew lines on maps and they said, here you go, Stalin. You know, here you go, one of the worst people who's ever lived. You have this quote-unquote sphere of influence. And he goes, right, okay, well, all that stuff's mine, so I'm going to march troops into there, and I'm going to communize all these areas, and then Europe kind of goes, oh, whoa, no, we kind of meant slightly different than that. You've still got to be part of our club. And what I realize now is that, you know, if Stalin had played ball, if he'd allowed the international financiers in there, if he'd allowed the Fed to fund, you know, the rebuilding of Eastern Europe and the communization of it, they'd been fine with it. He was their guy, and if he'd remained their guy, they would have been fine with everything the Soviet Union did post-war. They would not have cared as long as they thought they were still somewhat in control.
Yep.
But, yeah.
I mean, there are people that remember the Second World War and remember good old friendly Uncle Joe.
Uncle Joe, fucking, people used to have posters of him. People had pictures of Stalin on the wall. During the Second World War, they were given out. They were given pictures of FDR, Stalin, and Winston Churchill. You know, they were seen as the big three.
Yeah.
And Well, it's the big four if you include France, but lol, no one really thinks about France apart from being a staging post for invasions and counter-invasions. But yeah, it's a curious point of history, and it's how a lot of our history has been corrupted, really, is the propaganda surrounding the allyship with the Soviet Union. Because if the rhetoric of the democracies is to be believed at face value, that wouldn't have happened. They would never have allied themselves with a man like Stalin. You know, they would have seen it as unconscionable. You know, it's sold to us, you know, at worst as, oh, they, you know, an alliance of convenience. You know, maybe they were naive. But that is such a, frankly, retarded reading of history that I couldn't get past it. Oh, yeah. I couldn't get past the way the Cold War was taught to me, because it didn't make any fucking, especially the starts of it. Like, it's like, what did they think was going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I know that, I mean, after the Second World War, Churchill went and gave Stalin a bunch of jet engines, which were way ahead of what Russia had, and America was absolutely stunned in the Korean War when all of a sudden their jet sabers flying around suddenly found themselves up against Russian jet planes in the skies.
The early MiGs.
Yeah, they were furious about that, how on earth this had happened, because, you know, they still kind of thought Russia was their friend at that point.
Well, the thing is that the 50s, a lot of the early, you know, late 40s into early 50s, is America bending over backwards for the Soviet Union and going, come on, guys, you're still in our New World Order club, we can all rule the world together. And Stalin's going, I know what you guys did to Hitler, because you gave him that speech too. Because as we'll get to with Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and again, Sutton's idea, kind of, indispensable for this. We'll be using more of Leviathan and Its Enemies by Sam Francis. There's a whole bunch of literature here that, like, again, not to toot our own horn, but no one's really done this before. Mm. No one's really taken a lot of this alternate literature, and it all gels together so well on this subject of democracy and democratization. They all mention it, they all talk about it, and they all talk about different aspects of it. And kind of what it builds to is a completely different view of history. Like I said, this stuff is actually criminally underwritten about and undersourced and underexplored outside of the confines of itself. You get people like Hopper, who are, you know, quote a lot of Rothbard and Mises in their treatise, you know, against society, democracy, and the idea of human, kind of how we construct human interaction in general. He kind of pulls down all those falsehoods. But when it comes to, like, world history through the lens of how we ended up as mass democracies, especially with all the, like, the Rothbardy kind of, I guess what you call Mises Institute stuff, there's nothing really out there. There's a real dearth of historical resources told through, you know, you got a lot of left revisionism. You get a lot of Soviet Union apologism as well. But what you don't get is an, I guess, anti-Keynesianism, democracy skeptic view of history out there. There's, you know, outside of people like Sam Francis and Leviathan and Its Enemies, which I think is the closest work to what we're doing with this series, there really isn't anything. So that's really one of the other reasons I wanted to do this as well, is because, well, it hasn't actually been done before, you know, which is rare.
You know what is an interesting PDF? I actually linked it in the server. I'm going to push it again, because a friend of mine has been saying I need to read these for a while, and that's the Federalist Papers, which is pre-1776. This is, reading through just a little bit of this, is like, oh dear God, the Founding Fathers actually got all this. They actually understood the dangers of mass democracy way, way, way back then. And it was, that's, you know, people going, literally, you're paving the way for an elected king.
Sorry, people asked in chat, the book I'm referencing is by Samuel Francis, and it's called The Leviathan and Its Enemies. We've quoted it twice in our streams now, and it should be linked as a PDF in some of our reference material. If you look in the community tab, there's a whole bunch of references for the videos. It is a very raw, a very dense book, because it was published posthumously, because Sam Francis died before it was published, but it is kind of his magnum opus. It's his treatise on the idea of the state and, you know, it's really one of the only essential kind of philosophical and historical works that quote-unquote paleoconservatism, even though I think Sam Francis in Leviathan, Its Enemies, really just strays into just pure classical liberal libertarianism. It really just goes into that. It's kind of, it's almost like a treatise on why you can't be a paleoconservative. You have to be a, you know, very fundamentalist libertarian.
Yeah.
If you understand the theory of it and you understand what he's trying to say and you have at least done a bit of background reading, if you're like a very hungry for political literature and you're someone who's, you know, wanting to take the next step, I think that Leviathan, Its Enemies might actually change your life, because I know people who've read it and been like, holy shit, this is amazing. Because there's just so much stuff in there. It's just so good.
Worth looking through Leviathan as well, the first one, the Thomas Hobbes.
Yes, I was going to mention that, because that's the one I want to mention in maybe the theory stream that we do, because Leviathan and Its Enemies is a reference to an older book.
Yes.
One of the first examples of actually social contract theory, which we're going to have to go into at some point. It's difficult to figure out where to fit all these bits of theory into these streams, because a lot of it has so much context that needs to be added to it that it just doesn't fit, honestly. And it might, again, a lot of this stuff might have to be dragged out into specials. Because, like I said, once we've gone over the historical part, we can just do maybe 2-3 episodes of summing up and, you know, going over what we couldn't cover in the main body of the series. Because really, again, to get people to where I want to go and where we want to go, I don't know about you, Trig, but I, from my point of view, I think it's very important to demolish a lot of people's historical myths about democracy and the course of events that they set in place. And you can't talk about theory and, you know, you can't talk about democracy as this huge problem without dragging people out of that view of history.
Well, yeah, without wanting to get postmodern on the whole thing. Yes, you have to analyze and break down what you've got before you can start looking at something as a potential alternative, which is the other thing I think we need to do is perhaps after this, I don't know, we haven't really explored this idea, but perhaps explore some other possibilities.
Well, that's what I want to do. I'd like to do an episode about, like, a lot of people have asked us, you know, well, what do you suggest? What comes next? You know, what comes post-democracy? You know, what happens if we decide to, you know, go back to this era of incredibly small government, incredibly fundamental property rights, incredibly free market, and you remove most of what people would consider the state from people's lives? What happens next? And that is a whole other series in of itself.
I mean, I could easily sort of very flippantly sort of go city-state principalities.
Well, it's the thing is, the real answer is whatever we fucking want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is the real answer. Because, not to get, too much into esoterica, but I don't think the political language and the patterns of political thought and philosophical thought exist today to describe that. I think we are so engrossed in this post-war consensus period that, you know, the situation we're trying to get to in this series is, you know, you end up with a post-war consensus, quote-unquote. Like, that is the end result of all of this democratization. But within that framework, people just can't imagine a world without all these trappings. And all these trappings have really only existed in their current form since about 1950. Again, that's the point I want to get to when we get to the end of this. It's just, the world was not always like this, and it doesn't always have to be like this. But so much of people's thinking is rooted in the fact that this is permanent and this is neutral. They have been sold on the idea that the, you know, the post-war consensus is neutrality. You know, it is just the way things are. And it isn't. There are people alive now who remember a very different world.
Yeah. Yes, there are. It is only 100 years, give or take, ago, that the world was vastly different. Vastly different. I mean, I put my... We buried my grandfather, you know, a couple of years ago. And some of the things he remembers talking... And I remember him talking to me about prior the Second World War and how things happened for his father and so on and so forth, wildly different world to what we live in at the present moment. Wildly different. In fact, I must go and go through some of his notes, because I was telling you he was involved during the Second World War in some wild things, like camouflaging a lake in England via rope and barrels and bits of twigs and netting. Yes. So that the bombers that were flying up towards Manchester, basically they were using this lake as a point where of reference and navigation, because they didn't have radar in those days, and they were flying their bombers up towards basically via Stoke-on-Trent, essentially the Midlands area, using this lake as a lock-on point, and then going north straight from there to go and bomb Manchester. And yeah, my grandfather was out there with sticks and ropes and barrels as a young lad, camouflaging this lake. As a result, the bombers were flying off and blowing the crap out of fields instead of cities. You know, fair play to him. I know. Can you imagine that in this world, this day and age? You just stick in a GPS coordinate and the plane will fly exactly there. They can drop that bomb on the house they want to.
Well, this series gets ever lengthening. it's I don't know, it's almost Sisyphean. But when we eventually get beyond 1950 and talk about all the theory stuff and the implication stuff, and we talk about some of the alternatives and the way the world may look if you end up, you know, reversing all of this, but also with modern technology. I'd love to do, if we ever have time, post democratization, basically just go decade by decade, you know, do the 50s, do the 60s, do the 70s, you know, and just keep, you know, until we get to the 2000s, I think would be a good, again, the next 50 years, the second half of the 20th century, because what I'd want to do is I want to follow the baby boomers, because the trajectory the baby boomers take as the first generation in this post-democratized world is fascinating. It is a wonderful journey. I don't know, Trig.
Do you remember about 3 or 4, 5 weeks ago when you were like, yeah, "Hey, dude, we can do this. It'll be five episodes, maybe six at most. It'll be a couple of hours, 2 hours. We're going to cover this area. It's going to be a great series. We're going to be doing this. It's going to be well. Where are we now? We're the 1920s. I still think 20s to 30 is almost two streams. And then we've got 30s to 40s, which is mad.
Well,
and
the then thing is, no. What we're going to do is, like I said, we've taken a lot out of it with the consequence of the First World War. Sorry, I keep saying Second World War. And, you know, we're going to take quite a bit out of it by doing the whole Keynesianism and economics special in the middle of it. So I if you look at the notes we've got so far, let's kind of buy a pause. I think we have a logical way of doing 1920 to 1929. Without it being like 5 hours. I think we can make it with our normal like three. I guess it's a normal 3 hours now, but
you've
that's
said,
just the breaks, I guess.
You've said that every time so far, dude.
Well, that's true. I don't think we need to break it down anymore. I think we can do, you know, these are going to be long streams. We're going to cut them up at some point. Don't worry. People keep contacting me about that. There will be short form content with this subject matter in future.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think we have a sane way of doing the two interwar year streams, because we've got a little like the plan right now is, for those who don't know, because it's changed considerably. We're doing this because we just want to make sure that you guys understand what we're doing. You're up to date with, you know, where we are. You can, you know, in case there's any glaring omissions, we can address them. There's a couple of things I want to go through before we kind of, you know, end the stream. Yeah, I know we're rambling a bit. Which is nice. It's nice to just be able to talk in a free-form way without going, shit, what's in my notes?
Yeah.
because, yeah, we had, what was it? We have like 12 subject areas every time. I've tried to limit it to 12. And if you only speak on each subject area for 10 minutes, that's still 2 hours.
Yeah.
Just, which is wild to think about.
Just to bring your attention, James Murray has just brought up a good question, or statement, actually. So it wasn't all great back then. Widespread deprivation, incest, rape, and brutal work conditions. My family's lived in a very terrible area for generations, and it used to be so much worse. Yeah, but I mean, let's face it, rape, incest, etc. That's never been, shall we say...
It's never gone away.
It's never gone... Well, so, I mean, certainly not. Depending on where you are, there's been an awful lot of rape and underage sex, etc. have been going off since the 80s and 90s for various reasons. It's been bad. It's been bad in areas, but yeah.
During the summing up, I want to make the comment that the state is not responsible for all technological advancement.
Certainly not.
And the fact that certain things are better now, in terms of, you know, infant mortality, you know, we have more technology, but things are better in certain ways. Things are worse in other ways. I think the idea that the past was bad and the present is good is simplistic nonsense. And it's a lie we are told to accept, you know, what is done to us. I guess things were not perfect. I'm not saying that things 1900 were an amazing world. It wasn't a paradise. But they managed to go through the tumultuous Industrial Revolution without a lot of the problems we find ourselves with today.
Yeah.
That a lot of the ridiculous control we find ourselves with today. There's a lot of people who seem to think that we live in, you know, the golden age of everything, and we just don't.
No, but what we do live in is a golden age of technology. A lot of these things that have been brought about and have changed recently in the last, say, 100 years has been communication and technology, primarily. Regulation, governmental regulation, has, in some respects, kept things in shape from overrunning. But more often than not, it has caused a lot of hardship and crushed innovation. I would say that by and large, the fact that people have personal freedom in the form of vehicles, the ability to communicate over very large distances very, very quickly in the form of phones, the internet, etc., the amount of information technology exchanged through the internet as well, has really been a vast improvement. And certainly in the case of the internet, a lot of that, apart from the actual building of the infrastructure, has been rather anti-government.
People often romanticize the past, and they shouldn't. Things aren't better, things aren't worse, things are just different. That is the way I always try and communicate it to people. Mm. You know, you cannot know whether you would be happier in another period of time. And someone from another period of time cannot know if they'd be happier in this time. It's information we simply do not have. And all we can really say is that it's different. The world we live in today is very different. But whether it is better or not is a value judgment, and that is a value judgment that is made on an individual level. You cannot objectively say that today was better than yesterday and tomorrow will be better, which is what the incremental kind of march of history stuff says. It says that, you know, without a real plan, and, you know, just naturally, you know, the world will trend upwards. And it's what Hegel said, you know, society will always iterate on itself to make itself better and more free, and we're moving upwards towards paradise. And we demonstrably aren't. And, you know, if you study ancient history, there is always a collapse. And again, we're going to probably get into some of the Ted Kaczynski stuff at some point, but some of what Kaczynski seems to have to say is that, like, what happens when people are so, you know, there's the idea of learned helplessness. What happens when people are so dependent on technology when a crash happens, when a, you know, when a fall happens, when civilization breaks down? Isn't it incredibly cruel to make people so dependent on technology when inevitably societies always crumble, inevitably? And yeah, it's that there will be a collapse. Like, I don't want to, like, people think people are preppers who say that, people think they're doomsayers, but you cannot look at history and say this civilization is never going to collapse, because they always do. All civilizations collapse, and when it happens, we're going to have to grapple with the consequences of it. And that really is kind of the scary thing when you look at all the kind of the post-war consensus cushioned bubble that the baby boomers were raised in, because they were the first generation to live in a world without mass, you know, without the mass wars of the previous age, but with also all this democracy and rhetoric and propaganda on a direct level, and all this direct interference in their lives, and all this economic interference. Like, they are the biggest, I think, in terms of, I don't know, you know, mental state. They're the most pure product of the democratized age. And that's, I think, where they're so reviled. Like, people fucking hate the boomers, but the boomers are, like, they are the most susceptible victims to all the propaganda we've had. Mm-hmm. They are like the perfect blank slate, kind of almost like post-democracy pod people. And what they believe and the way they see the world is shaped by that. And fundamentally, a lot of them just live in unreality. They don't understand how the world functions. They were the first generation who was removed almost completely from the land. They were the first generation that was moved completely from, you know, mass conflict and mass strife. And they very willfully abdicated their responsibility for their personal safety, for their food, for, you know, their warmth, to larger entities. And to them, the world just happens magically. You know, it's a just go to the manager and ask for a job kind of shit, you know? It's like, that generation doesn't know, like, how reality works on quite a scary level. But it's endemic to a lot of people that come after them as well. It's probably endemic to me. It's endemic to all of you. You know, you... People are terrified of survival situations. And that's something, to me, that's troubling. That, you know, what happens when the lights go out? You know, what happens when you have to find your own food? People, you know, all the people in past ages, really, you know, pre-industrial revolution, that's how most people lived. They lived a bit more hand-to-mouth. They lived off the land, and a collapse would not destroy them. It might be harder to trade with people, but it wouldn't completely destroy them. But,
well, this,
you know,
is, we're getting into technological slavery, etc. And as I was about to say to Doc allegedly, who I just saw in the chat mention this, there's also medical slavery. Look at the... Say, the classic example is HIV and AIDS in Africa and various other places,
yeah,
where it's riddled the entire continent, and it's not done what people predicted in the 80s, which was caused this massive, almost extinction-level event, because the medical companies have jumped in and have been able to hold things back. But as a result now, you've got millions upon millions upon millions of people beholden to their states... Who to supply them with drugs? Who will buy that from drugs companies? And you've got an entire continent on literally medical slavery. They all have to keep paying the taxes to pay for the drugs so that they can fend off HIV from going to full blown AIDS. Riddled all over Africa, all over the place as well. And nobody even talks about AIDS anymore. It's you know, South Park said, you
it's
know,
almost passé.
It's passé. It's oh. You know, how very 80s and early 90s, who cares about AIDS anymore? It's a terrible thing to say because it's under control now. Yeah.
I can't remember what show it was on. It was like, dude, you have AIDS? That's kind of retro.
That's,
you know, was that South Park?
It was South Park. Yeah. I think it was they did it twice. There was the Jared had AIDS episode, which was the Jared Fogel, remember the subway guy? Who lost all the weight, and then when it turned out he was fiddling with kids as well. But prior to the pedo allegations, he came onto South Park and was like, oh, actually, I lost all my weight because I have AIDS. I'm not just positive. I'm HIV positive.
No, yeah. I'm not just sure. I'm HIV positive.
Yeah,
that was when
Cartman injected Kyle with AIDS, and they just found that they could cure it by... grinding up lots of money and injecting it straight into your bloodstream, which is actually a really, really good analogy for the situation. Yeah, that's as long as you've got enough money, you can keep that thing totally manageable.
If you think, by the way, our view of like 1900 to 1950 is going to be a bit radical, wait until we start getting into stuff before that period, because the further back you go, the bigger the lies get, because you're more removed from it directly. Like, I don't know how esoteric we're going to get, Trig, but we could start talking about the stated age of certain monuments versus, you know, the probable actual age of certain monuments. And the fact that ancient history as told to you is basically a lie.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, history from, like, 2000 BC to, like, 500 AD is basically just Roman and Greek propaganda of them wanking themselves off. And we don't know if most of that's true or not. There's a whole bunch of shit that people find constantly that just they have to bury because it just doesn't make sense with our view of history. There's so much stuff out there.
Are you suggesting we get into Hancock's idea of the pyramids being over 10,500 years old?
Maybe the Sphinx. Certainly make arguments for standing stones. I mean, there are some like just crazy Neolithic monuments in, you know, supposedly the undeveloped north. I mean, some of the oldest monuments in the world are in these supposedly provincial areas that were, you know, when the Romans found them in their time, they described them as barbarians. But the Romans described everyone who wasn't a Roman as a barbarian. So we can't trust their view of history.
Yeah.
I mean, we could start talking about the fact that, that the Greeks had myths of basically big, tall, lanky, Norwegian-looking people that they stole all their technology from. and the fact that the Sumerians always depicted their bringers of knowledge as having blue eyes. But
are we going to go down the route of the Norwegians and Celts being superhuman gods from prehistory?
Well, they certainly may have had a lot more advanced civilization than we give them credit for.
No, absolutely,
is something I'd like to get into.
Yes. Yes, we can. There's a lot we can get into. Oh boy, that's a rabbit hole for. We're gonna need some extra big tinfoil hats.
Fucking Hollow 1916. Yes, Hyperborean. Yes. Yeah, we're getting into esoteric Hyperboreanism. Let's talk about the Kirkwall Scroll and all that shit, or the what's that manuscript? There's like a manuscript. That's like written in a language that no one understands. And it was. I remember watching some fucking Adam Curtis documentary. He mentions offhand that some Russian ballerina was given a copy of it.
Oh really?
I don't know, man. Wait until you hear my fucking rant about humans and the stars. Because there's a whole bunch of shit about that. And how people process spirituality. I don't know. I'd like to do a stream at some point where I basically just tell people to read the Bible because they need to. you honestly cannot understand like post-Christianized history unless you like have a pretty good knowledge of the Bible, because that's what these people lived and breathed. Like, you can't understand the Enlightenment without having an intimate knowledge of the theology of the Bible. You just can't.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how people try and make sense of it without that. It doesn't make sense. Yeah, the Vedic manuscript. Thank you. Thank you. We might get to talk about some stuff like that.
Oof. Oh, you know, it's been a hell of a long time since I read the Bible. I actually did read it a long, 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 long time ago. Because I liked arguing with my school chaplain. He was quite an intelligent guy and was willing to have arguments, so I would go and argue with him quite regularly. It was good fun. Which Bible is a good good call, actually? Which Bible is a very good question, because there are a fair few. I don't know. King James,
I think. Mary mentions the Bronze Age collapse, which is the classic example, of the complete bullshit of the March of History theory of history. You know, shit like that happens all the time. Sorry, go on, Trick.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, which Bible? I don't know. At this point in time, we'd have to work out which would be the best one to root through. I've got so much to fucking read.
Again, we could talk about a lot of the... there's some good stuff also about the history of the Jewish people as told by themselves and the history as told by the archaeological record. A lot of the non-canon scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls stuff, a lot of the comparative mythology stuff of the stories that they stole from previous people and the stories they stole from previous people, and that many of these stories may be tens of thousands of years old. I don't know. I don't want to get into astrotheology anytime soon, but there's a good case to be made that all human religiosity comes from the fact that we measure the passage of the stars and tell ourselves stories about it.
you do realize you've just pretty much mapped out the next 3 years of this channel.
Like I said, there's so much to talk about. Like, I'm so fucking sick of people going, "Hey, have you guys seen what Anita Sarkeesian said now?"
I mean, I was kind of sick of that in 2016,
have you guys seen like I know we do it occasionally, and I would like to laugh at the headlines and talk about the headlines, but there's so much more beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's, like, I think people have been on-ramped enough with that stuff. Like, there's a huge group of people out there, some of which I'm friends with and some of which are okay, but, like, their content is just, hey guys, did you know feminism is bad? And they've been doing that exactly, they've been doing the same video for, like, 6 years.
How dare you dunk on our Lord and Savior Sargon like that?
I appreciate what Sargon's been doing with the whole Lotus Eaters thing.
You know when people said
go and build your own platform, he fucking did.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I made fun of him at first because the damn thing didn't work, but, you know, he has his own place now. He's a lot more difficult to yeet from the internet, and he's nutted up. A lot of people need to nut up and do that. I think he's head and shoulders above a lot of other people because he's gone out there and he's actually built his own platform.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's looked at what, again, Alex Jones had that and that's what saved him. But yeah, you know, a lot of people don't get into, you know, a lot of people are the thin end of the wedge, but there's too many of the people. People don't know where to go from there. And you have been so lied to. Like, you have been so propagandized about the past, about the present, about yourselves, and about the inside of your own mind that, you know, there is so much to do here for people. And again, we're all still discovering it, but I think there's a lot of subjects that will resonate with people that are exceptionally far removed from what is essentially the distraction of the headline cycle. Like, I don't want to pick on people, but, like, if you're just reading the headlines over and over again, you're doing what they want. You're engaging with the material they want you to engage with. You are essentially, you know, you're pointing at the stage show, not what's going on behind it. Most of that's just useless. You aren't engaging with the actual issues. You aren't seeing what's behind it, what's beneath it, and the historical stuff, you know, before it. It's fun to laugh at and fun to point at, but that's all it is. And I really just wanted to do more than that. And I think, I don't know about you, Trigg, but, like, the switch kind of flipped when we did the whole History of the Forever War stream.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people went bananas for it.
It was, yeah, no, that was a good stream as well. Because we covered the you know, the new boot and the crab bucket theory, etc. But yeah, no, it was you know, let's actually discuss what has been going off and what's been causing it. And
I actually, you know what, the more I think about this stuff, the more I think that the infinite crab bucket thing is actually a really good watch for people. And yes. Maybe I'm going to do more on it as well because it explains so much. Yes, there it is, like the Lotus Eaters.
you know that was our buddy Ez that put that together, and I know it's I've seen it pop up in other places, and I just want to doff hats to him. Actually, also, you know what, I've been meaning to say this a few times as well. The pixel art picture of me down in the bottom left corner. We have that Rev. If he's watching, yes. I've promised a shout out to Rev several times, and I haven't. Revenant did this work, and if you go on my Twitter,
I will give our
excellent work.
Yes, I'm going to say. For those who want to know, my avatar was made by a guy who goes by Pixel Yanosh. He's still around a little bit. This was made like 5 years ago. So yeah, that's where mine comes from. I know people have asked me that a couple of times. Although I got saddled with the star because it was my avatar at the time that the Gamergate stuff took off. That's the first time I got any kind of like public recognition, so I kind of got stuck with the whole star and the scrump name thing. Yeah, I should again give our essentially our researcher Duncan a shout out.
Yes.
I think they'll be officially changing their name soon because they are transitioning, as people know, because they've appeared on Rose's stuff before, and they've appeared on AA's stream a couple times, I think, as well. So they've got a profile on their own account. But yes, they've been invaluable in all of this because they own a lot of the literature I've been referencing.
Yeah, I don't think we could have done it without their help, to be honest.
We could definitely could not have done this without their help at all. This would have been impossible for me. Because I've read a lot of this stuff before, but it's all jumbled up in my head.
Yeah,
And same. I've read bits of it, and I've read PDFs, and I've seen references to it, and there's like, shit, I'll you know, what's that thing with the thing in it, and then there's the thing. You know, it's kind of like that in my head.
Uh-huh, I know, that's the same. You've been throwing all these sort of, oh, check out this PDF, and this one, and this one, and, you know, in fact, here, have 12,000 pages of you know, economics and political theory to read for next week, Drake. Thanks.
Well, the thing is, Drake, with someone like you, who is already, you know, not immersed in the cathedral, you know, you've left the cathedral of establishment ideas.
I was.
You are already an enemy of the Leviathan. For someone like you, that kind of shit's just like rocket fuel, though.
I know. A mountain of bleeding rabbit holes I've gone flying off down as well and gone, oh, well, we need to read this as well, and I'm going to cross-reference it. And, yeah, no, it's great fun. It's great fun. I can binge on this shit for days, weeks, months, years, and it seems I'm going to at this rate, which I'm really quite happy about, to be honest. Although, yeah, I do need time for my computer games at some point. I just want to play video games. God damn it.
It's quite funny that I've disturbed your video game playing. I'll try and link to it in the chat. Every time I've tried to link to their stuff, it's been yeeted for some reason. But, yeah. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Like, I've linked to their Twitter in the chat there, so maybe you'll give me. I should really start linking to them in the description. Actually, just
yes,
say
yes, they are. Research. They are our silent partner on this. To be honest, without yes, Duncan, we couldn't do this.
Well, they're going to be our non-silent partner the stream after next.
Good,
because they'll be on for the Keynesianism special. We just, like I said, we have to have a special stream about Keynesianism because Keynesianism is so fucked. It is so just incredibly fucked how the economic systems were organized kind of post-1920s.
It is. I still think we need to talk about Malthusianism as well at some point.
That's in the notes, don't worry.
Yeah, good.
We're going to talk about the tragedy of the commons properly.
Good.
We're going to bring in Sowell. Sowell's coming in, Burnham's coming in, Kaczynski's coming in. We can talk about, you know, maybe some of the Federalist Papers stuff, like you said. There's a huge like plethora of political theory that we just have not had time to bring into this yet, because there's quite a lot of fundamentals we need to cover. Like I said, it's kind of it's all of it. We're just using all of it. Like if you throw Hopper, Rothbard, Mises, you know, Sowell, Burnham, Francis, all these people in a blender. And you know, pick out the best bits, let the good stuff float to the top. You can really kind of synthesize something there that is really, really, really worthwhile and really underexplored. Like I said, there's a bit of the kind of like libertarian esoteric side of YouTube, but a lot of it is smaller than we are, honestly, and they're not exactly very newbie friendly. There's a lot of inside baseball there, which again I'd like to get onto at some point, but like there is a real dearth of materials that explains all these concepts to people in simple terms, because you know it's either you've been following Ron Paul for the last two decades or you know you're not really sure what the fuck's going on. We have a super chat here.
We do.
First super chat of the stream, I think. We've had a few members. Thank you for that, by the way. Holo1916 says, I went down the child trafficking, pedo, satanic rings everywhere rabbit hole. Unironically started seriously praying to Jesus after. It does make you feel like that. And a lot of that stuff is real. I mean, there is a lot of, like, retarded, you know, what I would consider misdirection out there. But yeah, a lot of that stuff is real. There's a lot of, like, bad shit going on. Pretty much out in the open, and it's terrible. But yeah, that's again. That's why we create the whole navigating the rabbit hole stream thing.
Ooh, and a donation from HK9410. I can't read what that says, but I have just seen it popping up.
Yeah, I saw that. $5 from HK9410. Again, thank you. Kind of funny how so many of us across the internet have ostensibly come together. We just wanted to play video games.
Literally, they started ruining the video games, and I looked up and started looking in YouTube, and that was 6-7 years ago, and here I am now. In fact, no. God, it was 7... It was 8 years ago. It was 8 years... Holy shit, I'm old. Oh, dear. But, no.
Again, James Murray there. No, we're going to explain to you exactly why the quote-unquote checks and balances of Keynesianism are actually more retarded. a lot of the stuff in there is just, it's terrible, because it's all, again, not to get ahead of ourselves, it's all based on kind of objective value theory, which is essentially the economics version of labor theory of value, if you know what that is. Keynesianism sits on a lot of the same logic that communism does, not surprisingly. And again, we're going to have to explain that in great detail. But yeah, if you know what labor theory of value is, and if you know what objective value theory is, I think you already understand why Keynesianism is retarded. But most people don't, and it's not taught to most people in those ways. So again, we're going to have to do a bit of what I would consider deprogramming.
Yeah, I'm going to need to do some reading up on it as well. I'm only vaguely, well, I'm vague, a little more vaguely, but familiar with Keynesian. But
By the way, the way they implemented implemented Keynesianism is actually way further than Keynes ever wanted, and ever advocated for. They are doing it in a much more, like they are, modern monetary theory as it stands is far more out there than pure Keynesianism was.
Mm-hmm.
It is far more like just ridiculous in what it posits and what it says, and the way it kind of builds on Keynes to create these ridiculous financial system situations that are so far removed from reality.
Yeah, literally. Modern monetary theory is gone. I mean, getting away from the gold standard, just, it's so theoretical now. I mean, it was always iffy. It's, I mean, you know, you still, you break, I don't know if actually I've seen the latest notes, because I haven't seen one in a while. It still says, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of, you know, £5 or whatever. These things have always been nothing more than a promissory note. It's an IOU for what actual money is. And
actual money is doesn't exist.
And exactly,
it's IOU for nothing.
Yes.
Your money isn't worth anything. And it never really was. that's the big secret. Also, again, James Murray saying it's the same issue that sinks centrally planned economies. Any economy with a central bank that has power to set interest rates and the money supply is, in my opinion, a centrally planned economy. Like,
yeah,
you're quibbling over terms there. But if you have an entity that can 100% control the money supply, 100% controls the level of reserves, and also sets the interest rates, that's a planned economy.
Yep. And the moment you
enter all Western economies are planned economies now,
yeah,
by the way.
The moment you've got magical money like this, sort of nonsensical stuff, the taxation just becomes a leash for everyone. It is, you know, if you can print money, then why do you need taxation? Someone memed that on Twitter, ages ago, and it has bugged me ever since. That, yeah, they're absolutely right. The fact that money is a very theoretical thing in the first place, the fact that banks can just print out loans, knowing that they never have to actually have the capital there to lend that out in the first place. The fact that all of this stuff, just money can be created out of thin air, and yet they still want 40% of your wages, it is just keeping the little guy in his place on a leash by an other, you know, control mechanism. It's disgusting. I get annoyed about taxes on a regular basis. Are you seriously asking us to go back to mercantilism? James, that's a good question.
I don't know. Again, we'll get into it. Let's get into the whole money cycle thing. We'll get into the constantly rotating economy stuff. I hate to be the guy who says read Mises and Rothbard, but read Mises and Rothbard. If you actually want to get a good grounding in what the alternatives to Keynesianism that makes sense, Mises and Rothbard, just find everything you can that they've ever written about economics. There you go. There's your next 3 years of reading. because there's a lot of stuff they talk about here politically, because the two are intertwined, but like, again, we can't just talk about economics, because again, we'd just be doing economics lectures, and I'm not an economist. I'm an engineer. Nicholas Van Neel with $5 there, saying looking forward to the Kingsman episode and eventual BTFOing of MMT, getting sick of Adam Friended saying MMT is the manner of God. I don't understand how anyone can look at MMT and not think, what the, like, and not panic. Like, if you understand anything about economics at all, and you look at MMT, and you actually see the way, like, economies are planned, and the complete non-value of money, and the fact that MMT is just lying to keep everything going. Like, if you had any level of faith in the idea that, like, governments know what they're doing, take a good deep dive into what MMT actually says, because it is, like, it will give you, like, an aneurysm. It is so just fundamentally retarded and so fundamentally out of touch with the reality of how humans behave and how just economies work. It is just horrible. And it's so much worse than some of, like, the abridgment that Keynes does and some of the faulty assumptions that's based on. Oh, man. I don't know. But what was your moment, Trig, when you went, wait, that's how they manage the economy?
Oh, God. It was a long time ago. Actually, you know, it was on two or three different sort of points in time, around about 2000 and early 2000s, shall we say. I was up to a couple of things. I just left a business venture I'd been involved in. I'd gone bankrupt horribly. A couple of other things had happened, and I ran into a YouTube video that was going around that was actually put together by a bunch of Marxists. That was explained. It was just propaganda. And the name of it is going to spring to mind in just a moment. God, Zeitgeist. That was the name of it. The video is called Zeitgeist, and it is real. It is real theoretical, you know, sci-fi space communism. The manifesto kind of thing. But it's very well put together in there. And in there, they do explain certain aspects of banking. And I picked that up and was like, okay, I'm going to run this past a friend of mine who I knew was working in the city. And I ran it past him. And he was like, well, it's complicated. That's not exactly how it works. And that's very simplified, but yes. Like a year later, we were discussing an area that he had been working in, and so on, which happened to be credit derivatives. Now I don't know if
you. Oh God! Yeah. He was one of those.
Yeah. Now he had actually got out and he'd gone and done some other stuff, but he was explaining this credit derivatives trading to me. And I believe it was 2007 when he was explaining this to me. And I literally turned around to him in 2007 and went, when someone opens the book on this and looks at this, and if all of these, you know, because this is going to collapse, this is utter nonsense, and there's no way this is going to bubble and burst. And it's like, well, we're in the bubble at the moment. And a year later, yeah, it burst horribly and took the world economies down, and we've still been suffering the ripple effects from the 2008 crash, which was credit derivatives and self-assessment mortgages, and those self-assessment mortgages as risks being tranched in with less risky risk packages, shall we say, and knocked out the entire banking system, and, you know, everyone then had to reach into their pocket and pay out all the poor bankers who'd lost their money, who, if we hadn't even looked at it, if we just closed our eyes and gone, la la la, this isn't happening, that crash would have never have happened. Because of the magical money theory, and because the moment you actually open the books on this, it's literally Schrodinger's economy. Yeah, it is alive until you open it and look inside it and realize what you've got there is a dead cat.
Yeah.
But you cannot run a world economy. You cannot run a national economy. You can't run a blooming household economy on a dead cat. And yet we seem to manage it. Because nobody wants to look in the box. Ever. And yeah, that's when I sort of went, no, this has all got to stop. I've got to find a better solution. And I've been scratching my head ever since. With the occasional brief few years out to play Mass Effect and PUBG.
it's just to me the idea that you can set interest rate. It's just nonsense.
Yes, actually,
interest rates are supposed to be a reflection of, you know, the preference people put into, you know, it's immediate versus long term. It's people's time preference to bring that term into it, which we'll talk about a lot in the Keynesianism stream. But the, you know, interest rates are not something that is static. They are something that is dynamic, and they, you know, people's desired interest rate actually differs in each transaction, and it differs in, you know. You know, it's allowed to within the economy itself, but at a central level, when you're setting interest rates, if you look at, like, economics as a measure of what people want, that doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
That is, you know, that is cart before horse.
HK9410 just nailed it. Yeah. The economy operates on a 40K orc logic, then, which is yes.
Yeah, 100% yes.
Yes, yes. Invisible pink orcs. Oh, purple orcs, isn't it? Yeah. The Dead Cat Bounce of a Black Box Economy should be your book title.
That would be a great book title.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, definitely. Magoot, I'm sealing that. Thank you.
Well, the central conceit of Mises and Rothbard is that the government has nothing to say about the economy. That functionally the economy is free exchange between people.
Mm.
And maybe they can have a role in enforcing fair contracts between them. And maybe they can have a role in justice. And maybe they can have a role in, you know, making sure that, you know, crime doesn't happen and legality. But fundamentally what they say is that interventionalism is not only wrong, it's evil. And that it's just led to all these disasters. And that every time someone thinks they know better than, you know, the people who want to make the exchange, that they fuck everything up. And they just go through all these examples that are exceptionally well-reasoned. And they show that really, you just have to let people exchange things in the way that they want. Otherwise, the economy isn't in line with reality, because of what reality is all the exchanges between all these people, and you can't measure it. You get into the knowledge problem, the calculation problem, and things like that. You know, the idea that you can actually measure the, you know, and plan for what people's desires will be in, you know, 5 years, never mind 5 minutes, isn't possible. What they say is just don't do it.
Mm.
Just don't give into the temptation. Don't think that, you know, you can essentially plead God.
Oh, mind reading is, yes.
What is really just the free exchange, mutually, you know, there's also a lot of zero-sum game stuff. A lot of people assume that the economic interactions are zero-sum game, where there is a victor and there is a loser. But what they don't understand is the concept of mutually beneficial exchange, in that there is not always a sucker and a winner. It's not always a scam artist and a victim, which is a really, you know, again, very Marxist way to look at economics. That there are exchanges that are mutually beneficial, and that's how the economy works. And if you can maximize that, you maximize, you know, economic activity. And anything else is just telling people what they want, rather than letting them get what they want. But again, we'll talk about that in much more cogent and, you know, theory-backed terms later. Got a $10 donation here from Gaius Nautius Caesar. So I would like to point out that MMT theory was coined by a German, just like how it was a German who coined the Great Reset. What is it with Germans and horrible economic theories? It's not just economic theories, it's also philosophical theories as well.
Oh, God, yeah.
I think the big problem is that Germany has always tried to strive to become an, like, its own exceptionalist nation, and that they I'm not joking. I think they overcompensate. Like a lot of the unified Germany stuff and the move towards unified Germany and the Prussian tradition stuff and all of that. A lot of the fact that a lot of the shit comes out of Germany is that through trying to strive to make itself a great nation, they have a lot of overinflated, grandiose, kind of globalist ideas, and they have done for hundreds of years, and they all end up feeding into each other. It's all the idealists' fault. German idealists were kind of not good.
I mean, I don't mind if it just stayed as ideas, but they're not. They go for the whole, let's actually make this a thing and destroy the world in the process, which has been a bit of an issue. Notice we've got a few more super chats as well. We've got a
yes.
Windtalker, missed the last few. Happy you guys are still going. If you've missed the last couple, Windtalker, we've got some. Whoa, you got a
I think some good live.
Oh, okay, okay.
A lot of people are like, damn, I didn't mean it live.
Yeah, no. If you missed the last couple of streams,
last week's was live.
I had a few things to do, and
No, we will soldier on if we can't actually stream on Thursdays, especially whilst we're doing the democratization series, because we need to get one out a week. Like, if this is ever going to end, we will just premiere them instead, or we'll just upload them as a video. But I prefer doing them live because you guys have some good feedback.
Yeah.
Canadian Histam, I think one of our members says, do you see the parallels between now Afghanistan and Syria and the expansion of Russia into Ukraine and the expansion of the banks before the Great War? Very much so, yes, actually. It is the exact same type of internationalism and interventionalism, state interventionalism, financial interventionalism, economic interventionalism, feeding into kind of, you know, international interventionalism that we saw then. All of them feed into each other. It's all the idea that if you manage things enough, and if you expand the credit enough, and if you essentially print yourself infinite resources, you can wage global war and conquer the world, essentially, through an illusionary amount of money, essentially. And yeah, no, there is a lot of parallels there, because it's the same cycle. And in many ways, it's the same fucking people. It's their descendants who are carrying this on. It's the same families that are in charge.
Oh God, very much so. Very much so. Sorry, I know I was a bit distanced there. I was reaching for a book on my shelf because, someone's just mentioned sort of Nietzsche was decent. I've got a couple of Nietzsche on my bookshelf. I haven't read as much of it as I'd like to. It's not my favorite philosopher. I actually always liked Machiavelli. I think he's misunderstood by a lot of people and not as nasty and bloodthirsty as people often think.
No,
he is.
No, people don't understand what he's saying. What a lot of Machiavelli is saying, and which we'll cover when we actually bring in James Burnham's The Machiavellians, because he talks about this in great detail. What Machiavelli is saying is that you must always assume this from people in power, and to not assume this from people in power and not act in these ways is so naive as to be useless, which I agree with.
Yeah,
I think that once you end up with people who are at the upper echelons, once you end up with elites, Machiavellianism is the only way really to deal with elites, and it's the only way that you can contextualize their thought process, because the only safe way to deal with an elite is to assume that they are a Machiavellian, and is to assume that they are maximizing their own profits and their own gain through, you know, whatever means necessary. You have to make that calculation, otherwise the world doesn't make sense, and otherwise you will get steamrolled. That's really what the Machiavellians say, is that you have to not be ruthless yourself necessarily, but you have to assume ruthlessness.
Yeah, I don't even.
Otherwise, you would just get killed.
I don't know if it's not. Yeah, I mean that. I guess a ruthlessness is what. I found the passage I was looking for, because this is one I really, really like. I'd just like to read this out for a second, because it always strikes me as this encapsulates a lot of what Machiavelli's trying to say. So a prudent man must always follow in the footsteps of great men and imitate those who have been outstanding. If his own prowess fails to compare with theirs, at least he has an air of greatness about it. He must behave like those archers who, if they are skilled, when the target seems too distant, know the capabilities of their bow and aim a good deal higher than their objective. Not in order to shoot high, but in so doing, aiming high, they can reach their target. And that was always the passage I always fall back to, because it's the idea of aiming high. It's the idea of following in the footsteps of greatness just to attain, if you like, the air of those that have you may regard highly that have gone before you. It's a very, very good book about, you know, generally comporting yourself in a way of power. It's not necessarily a terrible, terrible sort of philosophies.
I want to point out one thing we forgot during the other streams, which I put in a comment, but I want to say it on stream. Taft, William Howard Taft, who was president after Teddy Roosevelt, was the first president to be a member of Skull and Bones. A huge amount of public officials have been, But, you know, he was the first president to be a member of Skull and Bones. And, yeah, the other one was the... We talked about it a bit, but Leviathan, the book itself, the Hobbes book, was published, I think... Oh, shit, I've closed it now. But it was published in the 1600s, I think. Which is, it's what, again, it's a very, very early work, but it's a very, very influential work. It was by, it was by Thomas Hobbes, and it was published in 1651. And it was written during the English Civil War, for those of you who want to know how far back it goes.
Oh, the original Leviathan, yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and Sam Francis's Leviathan and its enemies is a direct reference to that. Its cover directly references part of the image on the front of Leviathan, too, the text. It's, you know, the man made up of the people.
Yes.
And we will get into possibly some of its ideas, again, during more of a theory-based stream I'm hoping to do after we've done the history here, because it's important to understand what the phrase Leviathan and its enemies mean. He basically means people who are against the total state. It's interesting seeing all these people who are, you know, someone like Sam Francis was supposedly a paleoconservative, but he's incredibly in line with what people like Mises and Rothbard were saying, in that he's very much, you know, again, Mises wrote the book Total War, Total State, which we quoted from, I think, a couple of weeks ago. And that, in it, again, has that kind of idea that, you know, it's the total state that brings about a lot of these evils. But yeah, it's, yeah, that's the image, and that's the image that's on the front of the Leviathan and its enemies.
Yeah.
And again, not to get too into the weeds here, but if you have a very good grounding in, you know, political theory going as far back as, you know, the 17th century, again, that book's a bit of a revelation to a lot of people who've read it. Because if you get it, you get it. And, you know, I'm not someone who's as immersed as a lot of people are in a lot of this literature. I'm a little bit more recent to some of it. But like I said, I'm kind of a magpie. I've taken bits and pieces from everywhere, and I'm quite aware of a lot of things. And even to me, I think a lot of the stuff in the Leviathan's enemies is incredibly worthwhile, because he's also one of the best people to recontextualize Burnham, James Burnham. And I think his ideas are some of the most essential ideas on modern governance. Managerialism just is what has happened. It just is the way modern democracies are governed. And we're going to get more into that as we get into people like FDR, who is like managerialism incarnate.
Yeah, whoa. Oh, managerialism. Oh, that's more I've got to read. Yes. And oh, we need a scrump past a Louis stream, as Trolls has said.
Yeah, I've talked to Louis before on stream. But yeah, we'll try and get him on. At some point. We're doing more of a general topic.
We could end up being streaming every night, and we wouldn't have a chance to actually do the research, which is. I would rather get the research right and do the reading and do one stream a week than be streaming every single night with people and just voicing opinions without being as well read as I could be at this point. But maybe soon. Who knows? I know we'd...
The reason me and Trig aren't so good at reading aloud is because we're both heavily dyslexic, and that's something we can't solve. I'm sorry we can't enunciate things as well as we do with our normal speech patterns. But we are both heavily dyslexic, so that is why.
Yes,
honestly, yes. That's just not something we're going to solve. We're not, you know, in many ways the best public speakers in certain aspects. We muddle through, but like I said, it's kind of no. There's not really many people doing this kind of stuff, especially on the quote unquote more skeptic side of YouTube, as people like to label it. There's just no one who's really moved into this territory who's trying to bridge this gap, so doing the best we can, really.
We try. I'm okay with poetry for some reason. I don't know why. But as long as I can get into a rhythm with something, as long as I can spot the rhythm in a poem, which sometimes eludes me. But
poetry is the worst for me. I can't fucking do that.
That's I guess I was When I was at school, they still beat people with sticks, and I actually was beaten with a stick rather regularly for being shit at reading, and poetry in English was one of those sorts of lessons. So, I have felt a ruler across my hands on more than one occasion, and it you know what I'm gonna say, as much as I didn't enjoy it at the time, it did work. You know, I can still bust out some. Was it the Jabberwocky? I know the first couple of verses off by heart, and I haven't looked at that book in forever.
Gay.
Okay, we're gonna be wrapping up quite soon, unless you guys have any more pressing questions. If you do, ask them now. Get your donations in too. You seem to be doing, guys. Thank you. Because we've just had two super chats here.
Yeah, we have.
Gaius Nautius Caesar again. The Germans are genetically altered humans that were put on Earth to test us to make sure we're ready for the galactic community.
Confirmed. That is true. That is it exactly. And that is secret knowledge, and you now have to sleep with one eye open for the rest of your life.
I don't know. Speaking of the galactic community, through a lot of my research into these streams, I've actually managed to kind of black pill myself on space exploration and NASA and all of that cool science stuff I liked as a kid. I've started to realize it was just a way for the US government to subsidize itself and burn up a lot of inflation, and that a lot of that was done horrendously inefficiently and actually may have set us back a bit.
Okay. In that case, I'm gonna dig out a passage from one of my favorite sci-fis for you right now. I'm gonna go through it. Give me a second. I just keep talking. There's a wonderful line. In fact, I think I can recite it. That we have to go to space, because at some point in the future, in billions of years' time, our sun will go out, and the human race will go extinct. The Earth will be swallowed, and when it is swallowed, everything of beauty that has ever been created by the human race will be lost for all time for the galaxy. And if we do not go to space, if we do not bust out of this solar system and colonize other planets in other solar systems, that all of that work, all of those creations, all of those great works of art, all of those great works of music, of literature, will be lost forever, and all will be for naught. We must go to space.
Gotta go to space.
Gotta go.
I'm having Portal 2 flashbacks.
Okay.
Hollow 1916 says, I've been reading St. Augustine's Testate Aquinas and Julius Evola's side by side. Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas. It's good to read. Makes an interesting frame of mind. Evola Metamorph's Runes is top tier. I need to read them properly. I've skimmed basically all of Evola's work because my girlfriend has them all. Also, Oswald Mosley as well. Interesting. Well, again, we'll be... There's actually some passages from Evola and from Mosley we'll be bringing in when we get to the Second World War. Because that's quite important. No, that we will be reading from Evola and Mosley, which is probably going to upset people. Because we've got Mosley, we've got Evola, we've got Francis. Apparently we've got all the dangerous quote-unquote Nazi literature, which it really isn't. Especially in this context.
Some of it is actually literally a bit.
The anti-state stream at the moment.
Actually, it's not Nazi, right? This is because I've been called up on this by someone going, make sure you get the difference between Nazis and fascism right. And it's actually more fascist literature, not Nazi literature.
Like, calling Evola fascist literature is retarded.
It's
beyond retarded. It's so stupid to call it that. It's like calling somebody a communist who's, you know, like calling Woodrow Wilson a communist. He's not a fucking communist. You know, I don't like that guy, but he's not a communist.
No.
There's so many examples of that people just can't label things correctly, so they can't interface with them. That annoys the piss out of me. James Mary, £5. Sorry for writing around. Oh, it's fine. No, I'm quite aware of the fact that my diction falls apart when I try and read something aloud. But like I said, I'm please be patient. I have dyslexia. Canadian Hindustan again with $5. I want to go to space. We can purge the filthy Xenos. There's a very compelling argument about public, you know, once you get into public funds, you start to talk about public waste. There's I'm probably gonna cover it in the streams when we get to the 50s, because in the when we get to 1950, it already starts to disappear into what our researcher describes quite aptly as Faustian space nonsense. which is quite a funny phrase. It's true though. A lot of it is just Faustian nonsense. And if space travel was so beneficial, we'd have, like, when the market starts demanding space travel is when we're ready for space travel. Until then, all we're doing really is just burning up vast resources for very little tangible gain. And it's kind of depressing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, landing probe on meteor or comet gets us very little other than information. But that information isn't... This is where, yeah, it's not, the free market's never going to drive this, because the...
I think it would do at some point, but like, the idea that, like, we should take billions and billions of people's, like, incomes and fire them into space, like, on an objective level, just seems like, what are you doing? There's a very compelling, again, once you get into public funds and you talk about societies like this, the left has a very compelling argument of, why isn't this money feeding people, you know?
Why aren't we
addressing our human concerns before we address our lofty space ambitions?
Oh, why are we sending money?
Why is prescient human suffering less important than putting a man on the moon?
Why are we sending money in foreign aid to China?
Yeah.
Why are we sending money in... I mean, really, why are we sending money in foreign aid to China? But, whoa! But, you know, we've got homeless people on the streets and we're sending money to warlords in Africa. There is... Yes, but...
Like you said, if billionaires want to spearhead space travel on their own dime, that's their business. But
sure.
SpaceX is an example of that. It's just heavy... It's just NASA money, funneled through the private sector. It's not actually private sector. Their client is the government. So you can't really say that that's being done privately, because it functionally isn't. But I don't know. There's a song from the 1960s, I think from 1969, actually. And a line in it is, crackers on the moon, niggers in the streets. And that, you can't really argue with that, because it's true.
Oh, I just finished reading Heinlein's "Moon is a Harsh Mistress." I've taken time off to read some of my own stuff, but Heinlein does sort of make some good arguments for space travel, and if just for taking the high ground so you can throw rocks at the Earth when they get out of order, the Moon might be a good idea.
Portrait still makes a good point though, and yeah, space travel is essential. We need to find the alien space babes.
Agreed.
This is true.
Bloobs may be important in the future.
Fucking bloobs. Oh. Right. Anyway, guys, if you don't really have any further questions, I think we're going to probably make this one a slightly shorter stream, because holy shit, they've been terribly long. Plus, my girlfriend and our housemate are sat downstairs watching X-Files, and I'm missing it. I'm missing it, Trig.
Oh, early X-Files is great.
It's so good. I probably missed a classic episode. We're on season 2 right now. It's really fucking good.
Oh, is it season 2 or season 3 with the Tombs episode? Because Tombs is really freaking creepy.
I don't know. I've not seen it yet.
Tombs? Really? I'm envious.
Where am I? You know, I'll give people like a live update on where I'm fucking up to in the X-Files. Because I literally, it's going on downstairs without me. This is what I'm sacrificing for you guys. Well, like, early in season 2, a lot of it, I've watched quite a bit of it syndicated, but it's always been, like, extremely disjointed for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been, like, watching it in bits and pieces. I think we were just getting done with the episode Sleepless, which is episode 4 of season 2, which is the Vietnam vets get their fucking, like, pineal glands cut out so they can't sleep.
Yeah.
So they're always awake shit, which is actually kind of cool.
Yeah, no, I remember. No, if you haven't run into the Tombs episode yet, you'll like that. That's the guy that can stretch through very, very small spaces. Can literally sort of insert finger into keyhole and sort of stretch himself through the door and out the other side. Really creepy shit. And it's done by a really good actor whose name escapes me at the moment. But yeah, he's very creepy and very, very good. It's a good episode. Good standalone. I think he comes back once or twice, but it's a nice not an alien one, or is he? Yeah, there we go. Magoot knows. Tombs is an awesome character. One of my favorite offshoot episodes. Yes, the flatworm guy. He's basically a flatworm in human format.
You know, there's a lot of characters actors in that show as well. Mm. Like, I've been doing like character actor spotting, 90s shitbox spotting with the cars, because there's so many fucking GM and Ford shitboxes in there, like low spec ones too. And also, there is a horrendous amount of stock sound effects in season one. Like, to a if you know the stock sound effects, which you will, there is a jarring amount of them. Because the reason they're so buried in my skull is because especially Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl uses so much stock sound effects. And they're all in X-Files. And I'm just like, oh god. They played like four stock eagle noises in a row at one point, and I'm just like, stop.
Hey, on the Stalker subject, I've been playing Anomaly recently. Stalker Anomaly is really, really, I mean, it's wildly horrifying. And
fucking Crown Vic pilled, yes.
Very, very good, yeah. Yeah, Stalker Anomaly, great game. Great fun. I mean, it's basically a revamp of the others. But was it you that posted that to me?
Because I know yes, it was. I am the Stalker expert.
Yes. You keep throwing new Stalker games at me, and then that's it. I have to run off and play it for ages, and it's too much to do and not enough time.
Pretty sure I saw like a 1991 RX-7 in the background at some point, though, which was based and JDM pilled. But
nice, the RX-7's a good car.
Oh, the 90s RX-7s with the pop-up headlights on them.
Yeah.
Exceptionally initial D.
Oof, great, great motor, that one.
I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of the Wankel engine. It's an interesting engineering concept, but
it's fun to say.
It is fun to say.
Hey, no, James Murray, you're wrong. Stalker 2. There have been trailers for it. It apparently out either this year or next.
Oh yeah, they brought back GST Game Mode for it.
Yeah, yeah. No, like, Stalker 2. The trailers are looking very good. The gravity anomaly crushing a car and lifting it up and then crushing it again.
They've got the spirit of it. Yeah, at least.
I mean, we'll have to see, because there's been an awful lot of, oh, I'm really looking forward to this game, and it being a bit of a disappointment.
they uploaded a month ago to their YouTube channel. They uploaded some stuff in late March.
Yeah.
It's been done in UE4, which is probably a good thing, to be honest, because as much as I like the jank of the X-Ray engine, it is an engine that basically dates from 2002. So, yeah, I'm glad it's not being, they're not being like, we're going to do X-Ray. It's just like, oh, God. What is this Ukrainian nonsense? But yeah, if you've got nothing else you want to talk about, Trig, I'll do some final shilling, and then
I'm gonna show briefly for the D&D stream that I've been doing. Well, we've done two episodes in the last 8-9 weeks or so, but myself and Uzalu and Wes. And a few other people have starting a D&D stream. We've been doing that on Uzalu's server. I don't know if it's actually going to end up on YouTube. I believe it is at some point. But that's been... we actually had our second episode, finally, after many, 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 many false starts. That happened on last Sunday, so we're going to have another one on this Sunday coming. So who knows? You may see the character that I am using as my... My profile avatar at the moment with the white hair, basically looking like Geralt but with guns. That is that I'm playing that in a D&D game with Uzalu on Sundays. There we go. I've actually shilled something now.
We've got our normal stuff here. Me and Trig are both on mine.
Yes.
Follow us there. Trig's also still on Twitter. All the links in the description. You can join my Discord down below. Obviously, sorry about seal of approval. I was very ill yesterday. I think I mentioned it earlier. A couple of people asked why, and that's why I've been rather unwell. And yeah, that's really kind of it. Like I said, seal of approval is usually 8 p.m. on a Wednesday. And obviously, this show is 9 p.m. every Thursday. And for the next little while, at least for the foreseeable future, we'll be doing a lot of esoterica and historical stuff, which seems to be what you guys like anyway. So yeah. We're not going anywhere, and we're going to keep this one up. So thank you for tuning in. Thank you for all your generosity. Thank you for the new members. Thank you for all the super chats and donations. it's been very, very good seeing the growth of this channel. Very unexpected, honestly, because usually you get absolutely reamed being a small channel on YouTube.
Yeah.
But it's been great. It's been good, and I'm enjoying this journey so far. So we'll see you guys next time.
It's been loads of fun so far. Yeah, absolutely. Take care, everyone.